I'm the only one in our county who did secondary
school education. Yeah. Today is November 19th, 2005. We're in Metrosen doing an interview with Ernest Clark, and I am Jessica Wood.
Yeah. Well, how about you start by telling me how you got involved with the military?
Well, it all goes back to when I was very young, and when I was about 5 years old, I was in the Cubs, and then the Scouts, and Second World War time, it was mandatory that all junior high students had to be in the cadets. It was mandatory, and I was a lieutenant in the cadets. And then from there, I went to the militia and stationed in Abbotsford at the airport, and some training in Camp Wainwright, Alberta, the swamps, and Camp Borden, Ontario. And we did, well, at the airport, we had everything. It's called standing orders, and you have, like, right from transport trucks, you have standing orders, which is like a driver's license to drive tanks. So I had standing orders, everything from motorcycles to tanks and huge recovery trucks. It was just all part of the training, and I have the old in civilian life. I still have the old little tin aluminum licenses.
Oh, okay. And were they really small, maybe two inches by four inches?
Each year they were a different shape. So if you got pulled over, all they had to do was look at your license hanging on the mirror, and they knew whether it was current or expired. And that was
how they knew. Now, you said that you came from a military family?
Yes.
That was your father and your siblings?
My father, my grandfather, all my uncles on my mother's side, and my father's side. On my father's side, they were First World War. And on my mother's side, they were Second World War. But I was caught in the age group where I was too young to go overseas. I tried, but I got caught.
How was that?
Well, because you had to be over 18. And I'd been for posting out of the country, but I got caught.
And like your father?
Like my father, he used a dead man's name and age and went overseas. And when it came time for his, when he was getting old enough for his pension, then he had to come clean. I mean, I have never talked about being in the military to my sons. It's something that you don't talk about. My father never said one word about it. We didn't know as youngsters that he had been in there. Military, because it's always been taboo. Just something nobody talked about. I mean, they went through hell and came back, and there's a lot of the military people are ex-military. A lot of them had a lot of mental problems because of what was going on, and they got treated pretty bad. Prisoner of war camps, and they were very bad. And everybody's always, just like in, say in real life today, there's a lot of people, and you find growing up, there's a lot of people that want to play mind games. And as Aboriginals, one time I went for a job interview with the government, And one of the questions they had on in the interview at the round table was, have you ever had felt prejudice? And one of the, there was five of us, and it was BC Hydro, as Aboriginal education officers. And one of the girls that was with me said, I feel prejudice right in this room. Her interview lasted 20 seconds. And that's what we grew up with, is prejudice.
Even within the military, I'm sure.
Well, yes, definitely. And we have it all our lives, prejudice.
So do you think that's one of the reasons your father didn't talk about his service?
No, they just, my father was born in Ontario, but it's just something they never talked about. It's something they did, but because they had, you know, wanted to do it. My father went because his brothers were already gone. But, you know, just a big void in his life. He heard that they were, had died, and they heard the same thing. Checked with the war office, and they were missing in action and presumed dead. And so it was forgotten about until the Legion in Chilliwack said, let's put a tracer on the family and see what distant relatives.
So it would have been hard to find your father because he had registered under a different name.
When he went overseas, yes.
He went overseas.
Well, they, when they did check with the war office, they said that he was missing in action and presumed dead.
So they told each of the brothers the same thing, that everybody were, was missing in action.
They were told the same thing until my dad, at the Legion in Chilliwack, they said, let's just, for the hell of it, Frank, we'll put a tracer on your family and see what distant relatives you have. And they found out that not only were the two brothers alive, but while he was in that 52 years, there was three more children born while they were overseas. And so it was quite a family reunion, over 500 people. Just because, you know, ours is a large family. And I still have 9 sisters living.
Out of how many?
14.
So how many of your siblings served? You said your sister served as well?
My sister was Second World War. They just had the 60th anniversary due in Victoria. And my sister was able to go. She's 81. She's in a rest home with Alzheimer's. But she did go. And one of my nephews took her. And she quite enjoyed it. And they have the 60th anniversary cake at the Pro Pats Legion. And so it was a good day for her because her mind was quite clear. So the old timers, you know, it's pretty hard.
You were mentioning as well that you work a lot in the community now for Aboriginal veterans. Is there, what's that been like? You were the president for a while.
I was president of the National Aboriginal Veterans, and I've always been involved in the community. I've been, you know, involved in the Legion. I've always been a member of one of the Legions, and mine went blank. But, you know, I was a director of the Human Rights Coalition for years. I was a director of race relations. I was a director of Vancouver Island Memorial Society. I was a director for BC Memorial Society. And I keep pretty active. Mm-hmm. And as you know, I'm still involved in a corporation. And we have a brick plant, which is called Sumas Clay Products, on our reserve. So I usually go over, you know, once a month for band meetings. And for 69, I still keep a fairly active lifestyle. And
you were involved in the Veterans Memorial at the Ceylon Food Center as well.
Yeah, the memorial wall. I was on the committee for 3 years, and we raised $80,000 to do that wall. And we were a little short on the financial end because of the delays in building the arena. And the Ida Chong, on behalf of the Premier of the province of BC, they helped us out by loaning us the balance of the money to pay off the wall. And so it was nice to see it right through and then to be honored for doing it. But it's a beautiful wall. Hope you get down to enjoy it too.
And you just recently were at Government House with Iona Campanella?
Yes, for the presenting of the first poppy. And I also presented her with the Aboriginal poppy, which is the beaded poppy, which I got a nice thank you letter from her, and she wore it in Vancouver on November the 11th. Showed her on TV wearing it. She's a wonderful lady. She's always been involved with veterans, and she comes from a fishing family. Her brothers were fishermen, and Iona has been out on commercial boats. And she's a wonderful lady, and good for the community.
You're also saying you're involved in another memorial project.
Yes, I was chairman of the memorial committee to build the new cenotaph in Langford. And pictures on the wall.
So that's right in Langford.
Yeah. The cenotaph right up the Millstream and Goldstream are Veterans Way. Yeah. Took a year to build it. And, I took daily pictures, cataloged the whole thing as progress went on.
You also attended the University of Victoria. You're an alumni.
Yes. I did the certificate in the administration of Aboriginal government. And I still have three semesters to do to finish off a diploma in public sector management. But we did it the hard way. We did one semester in 5 days, which was a total burnout, you know, to still be working at the same time. But we graduated at UVic, and then we had a second graduation ceremony in the Mungo Martin Longhouse at 7 o'clock at night. And some of the students chose not to graduate at UVic, just in the Longhouse. But we had a pretty full schedule, mm-hmm. like doing it in a semester in 5 days. It was pretty tough. That's what I want to say, a lot of working. Because then I had a property management company.
And that was in 1993?
92. May of 92, when I graduated.
You ended up in one of the UVic catalogs as a result of that on your graduation.
In the President's Annual Report, I was the first Aboriginal student to be asked to be in the President's Annual Report. And also, unknown to me, Bill White is involved in UVic, and he asked if, you know, there were 1,600 students graduated in 3 days, so we had to form up in different rooms. And Bill White said, "Ernie, when you come out of the building, I'll be standing outside, so look at me." And unknown to me, the Times Columnist photographer was beside him. And I looked and I kind of waved at Bill, and at the same time, Times Columnist photographer took the picture. And the next morning I got a phone call at 6 in the morning, "Congratulations, Ernie, you made it." And I said, "How do you know?" And he said, "Your picture's on the front page." Times columnist, and that was quite a shock.
You've documented a lot of the work you've done in the community.
Yes.
Quite a bit.
Yes. I've led an active life, and still, for 69, I'm still involved in something pretty big.
You also said that you were part of the Aboriginal police training.
I went to the First Nations Tribal Justice Institute. I was going to drop out because it was a lot of repeat of the law and from university. But the elders told me I wasn't allowed to. So I had to spend 10 months at the Tribal Justice Institute.
And how was that for you?
It was good, but it was a lot of repeat of law. But, you never quit learning. And I'm always learning something new and involved in something new, and it's always good to be doing things in the community and helping. And
you seem quite balanced in both communities, within the Aboriginal community and the military community as well.
Yes, you have to be. You know, like I say, like being Coast Salish territory is from Hope to Vancouver, and then on Vancouver Island, it's from Victoria to Courtney. And so we're all, and because I'm involved in many different things, I sometimes sit as an observer, or in the treaty negotiations, because being interested in it, and we are going through negotiations ourselves with the Sumas First Nation. But we've been pretty fortunate that ours is going smooth, and we've already settled two claims without going to court, because we have the proper documentation, and that's the big thing nowadays, is the documentation. And even though our traditionally Aboriginal history is all oral, that myself, I have a tape of our history, and our family is documented going back to 1600 on the same property, on the Sumas First Nation, which traditionally was from the Sumas Mountain down to the Nooksack River. So it's on my status card, it just says Sumas, like not Sumas Canada or Sumas Washington, because there was no border. And it's just our territory.
Okay. You were mentioning as well that your father-in-law served. You showed him a picture of him earlier. And that your
father... He was provincial police.
Oh, provincial
police. My late father-in-law, he was provincial police.
Mm-hmm. And you showed me a picture of your grandmother. But you're saying she had the tattoo on
my great-grandmother.
Your great-grandmother.
My great-grandmother, yeah. Princess Mary Shishovka. And she had the square box with the half moon.
On the inside of her wrist?
On her right wrist, on the inside, was a square box with the half moon.
Tattoo.
Yes. And next time we get together, I'll play you the tape, because our family history is oral. And our elders, I have one elderly aunt, and she is the last of our hereditary storytellers. So we asked her if she would do our history on tape so we wouldn't lose it. And she did it for us, and I have a copy of it. This tells all about the history, and her having the tattoo of the princess, and it's quite an honor. Descendant of a, because we're classed as highborn, the descendants of the princess.
And you found a picture of her in the Smithsonian?
In the Smithsonian, yes.
Mm-hmm. You've done a lot of research.
Yes. And we have the birth certificates and baptismal certificates, because everything turn of the century was recorded by the Catholic Church. And we spent a lot of time in Vancouver, and it was like 75 cents an hour. We had to pay the pittance to the priest to translate everything from Latin to English, because everything was recorded in Latin. And so all the documents that I have has all been translated from Latin to English. And, you know, the birth certificates and baptismal certificates, and we had a lot of, you know, of history.
You said that you had had your dress uniform in that before.
Well, from the 52nd Armored Division, our dress uniform was the royal blue with the gold stripe and the fancy gold on the sleeves. But everything was destroyed in a fire. But I don't know how I ended up with my discharge certificate.
And that's what was saved from the fire.
That I had it. I had it.
Yeah. You were saying before that it was mandatory for everybody to be involved. So was there a lot of people then from your community in CMAS that were enlisted or part of militia? So like a group?
Well, there was no. We had. I was the only one actually from our reserve that went. And my younger cousins were after me, and that enlisted. Mm-hmm. Another one of the fellows from our reserve was Kenneth Ned, and he was a helicopter pilot. He ended up. He was overseas, and he ended up serving out his time at Comox Air Base. He was a rescue pilot that went behind the enemy lines.
That was from your reserve?
Yes. Yes. And my uncles were Second World War, Fred Kelly and Henry Kelly, but they both came back from overseas. Mm. You know, there's quite a few different ones from, you know, in our area. But Ernie Agri was an air ace, Second World War.
Agri?
He was a decorated pilot. And so it's just, there's so many forgotten people, or we call it, you know, the forgotten faces.
So is that why you endeavor to work so much within both communities now?
Well, no, it's just I'm interested in, you know, seeing our people, you know, get more involved, and when the longhouses were outlawed in Canada, and this is like when I was, say, 4 years old, I remember going down to Washington in the winter because they were outlawed in Canada by the government. And as you know, like the Indian residential schools, how I escaped the residential school was when I was young. My mother moved us to Victoria from the reserve, and I went to grade 1, 2, 3, and 4 in Victoria, and then we moved back to Kilgard. But then they had a two-room school. So
your mother was very passionate about keeping her home.
Yes, out of the residential schools, which was lucky for us. Because of all the problems at the residential schools. And, you know, over the years you hear of all of the problems at the residential schools, and how the priests and the police came right to the reserves and took all the, just grabbed the kids. And when they went to the residential schools, they weren't allowed to speak our languages. They would get strapped if they did, and that was pretty hard when you got to cope with the churches as well as the government. But we survived.
And well. And well.
And I hope so.
I'm going to pause for a minute. So I was just asking if you had any memories of when you were in the militia and the Scottish regiments. If you had any memories of that you might want to share.
Well, one thing, you know, being from a poor First Nations family, we didn't travel much. So when in the militia, I got to go across Canada by train. From Vancouver to just outside of Toronto, just Barrie, Ontario, and there we were bused into the base, and so it was a really good trip and an experience, first time to, you know, to get away from home. Just turn it off for a second, Jessica.
Certainly.
Thank you. Yours takes the full-size tape. Yep. I was having problems with our recorder. We're trying to rewind the one tape, which has our family history on it, which was done with the city.
So you were going to tell me some of the memories you had of when you were with the militia and you traveled back to Borden?
Well, going back to from Vancouver, we arrived in Ontario in the middle of the night. So we were there then, bused in the dark to Camp Borden, and we didn't believe how big of a place it was until we got there. And while I was there, I was given the job as security for a Brigadier General. And so everywhere he went, I went with him. And it was, you know, quite interesting to go from the reserve, and then all of a sudden you're looking after an officer. Pick him up in the morning and take him where he wanted to go, and it was something. Even though I was practically too young to drive, I had standing orders, you know, to operate all vehicles and motorcycles and tanks and recovery trucks, everything. So it was, you know, it was a learning experience, and to be able to do it, which a lot of people don't even learn to drive until they're 20 years old or something, even up those days, because not everybody had a car. I mean, we didn't have a family car. You relied on others to shopping and whatever if you didn't grow your own. It was a good experience, and I'd probably do it again, but maybe if it had been different circumstances, I probably would have stayed in and drew pension from the military. But, you know, well, times change, and nowadays I think that it's a good experience for people to, or for, you know, coming out of school, because where can you get better training and pension? But, you know, when myself growing up, you never thought about too far down the road. And pension and education. I dropped out of school in 1 month into grade 11 because Mum had passed on, and I was another mouth to feed, and I went to drop out, and I'm the only one out of 14 that did go back to went to university. And one thing they threw at us at university was 2-hour English exam. And Dr. Frank Cassidy came into the class. We were in a law class, and he came in and said, in 15 minutes you're going to be writing a 2-hour English exam. And he said, but don't worry, we have an English professor on contract. Anybody that doesn't pass will be taught. About a week later, he came back into the class and bellowed out, you all passed. which was quite a shock, you know, because speaking for myself, I never finished, made it through high school. But we were smart enough that we did make it. It was a good feeling.
Yeah. How did it feel the day you graduated?
It was really, really good. Really good, really special. And it was good to be, you know, the first all-Aboriginal graduating class. But we were all Aboriginal students. And we had very little problems. But, everything went fine. And we were the first students that did not have to kneel. Convocation.